This podcast is brought to you by LMU Munich.
How do things affect us? Dear ladies and gentlemen, with this question, I would like you to welcome you to my presentation on the affectancy of things. And as I was already introduced as an archaeologist, it's not a surprise that I will present my archaeological perspective on this issue. Moreover, I would like to thank the organizers of the symposium for kindly inviting me to contribute. In order to understand the potential of things, I would like to introduce in my lecture the terms changeability and affectancy. With these terms, I would like to overcome the long and rather fruitless discussion if things possess agency. And also, Tim Ingold yesterday emphasized that we shouldn't use this term anymore. Many of these attempts run the risk of anthropomorphizing things in a radical act of reevaluating things after they had been ignored by many cultural and social sciences for a long time. In the following, I will conceptualize the changeabilities of things and their affectancies and their affectancy, which relies on these changeabilities. I will demonstrate this potential. I will demonstrate the basis for this potential and illustrate my lines of thought with a case study, in this case from the Bronze Age Eastern Mediterranean, from cups coming from Crete to Israel. And then in the end, I sum up with the question, does it really help to introduce this vocabulary? And I will speak about, in the end, summarizing about the epistemological potential of what I propose. So my understanding of changeability and affectancy first requires a definition of the substance or substances and materialities of an object. Substance has been defined in many different ways and has not found much interest in material culture studies until recently. And Tim Ingold, who is here, was one of the key defenders of enforcing. He calls it material, I call it substance. But basically, we speak about a very similar thing, and it's only a matter of if you prefer to speak about material substance. I personally don't care. And others like also Bjørnar Olsen have very much pointed out to the importance of this. I define substance as the material a particular thing consists of, following Hans-Peter Hahn's and Jens Sönken's definition. At first glance, substance seems to be without any shape. However, every substance has a microstructure, which is most important for the possibilities of shaping. Substances can be natural, like water, stone, metals, or produced by humans, like alloys or rubber. So rubber is also a substance. We should never make the mistake to confuse a substance with something which is natural. This is not the case. A substance can also be something artificial. Therefore, substance, in my definition, is the physical and chemical quality of a thing or a part of a thing. Substance is shaped into materiality by cultural practices, as Thomas has put it. A thing can consist of different substances, for example, a necklace made out of different pearls, a car, a house, etc. From an analytical perspective, they can be subdivided into their substances. The things which surround us enter our awareness from time to time in different ways and intensities. At the moment of perception, a thing is classified and becomes an object. Materiality is defined by me as the physical presence of an object within the material world, which is perceived by a human individual at a particular moment. So materiality is intrinsically bound to perception, to individual momentary perception of substance that has been shaped within a cultural practice. In my understanding, materiality is inseparably connected to perception and especially our perception of things. When we think about things or interact with them, we regularly perceive them as stable and static, and we have already discussed this also yesterday. However, Maurice Merleau-Ponty has pointed out to the dynamics of the perception of things, which is always in a flow. Due to the fact that our perception of objects is permanently changing, the object changes in itself, even if just in our perception. I would like to call this phenomenon the first changeability of the object. The changeability is not related to a physical or chemical constitution of an object, but only refers to its perception. It is the perceived materiality which realizes in ever new ways during practices with the object. Materiality is nothing stable. It changes permanently because we perceive objects differently every time we do practices with the object. The first changeability is therefore only a perspective change of the object. An important reason for the relevance of the first changeability is the character of the first perception of an object. In the first moment of perception, we often do not see the thing in its particular existence, but we look through the thing and only perceive a certain class or type of objects. The potential of the first changeability becomes very evident in the standard archaeological practice of evaluating objects. Even if archaeologists possess a more or less sophisticated system of classification of prehistoric objects, they do not reflect on the particularity of an object in the first moment of encounter, but they just see the type or category which they attribute the object to. All categories of objects are also adorned with a particular name, which often already communicates a particular function and or meaning of the object. If we name a vessel cooking pot, function and meaning are inseparably connected with the object and its designation. Through repetitive designation of an object as cooking pot, this interpretation becomes so natural and self-understanding that we do not reflect about any possibly much broader range of further functions and meanings. By using function and or meaning specific categories, we ignore that functions and meanings are rather processes than states and only constituted through social practices with the object. If we find out that an already classified object does not fit in the respective category, we are puzzled, sometimes even angry, and we are often reluctant to accept this change of perception. The object irritates and affects us. It has an effect. The change of perception of an object is closely associated with the routes an object was brought along. It is its itinerary. I use itinerary instead of the problematic biometaphor object biography. In contrast to biography, itinerary does not introduce the notion of living and dying of objects. However, the complexity of these itineraries of an object in its substances and materiality has not been sufficiently acknowledged so far. Therefore, I would like to differentiate between the itinerary of the materiality and the itinerary of the substances of an object. Both itineraries are entangled and constitute the itinerary of an object. So what I've written here, the itinerary of an object is itinerary of the materiality plus itinerary of the substance, is depending on how many of them there are. However, and this is why I spoke about materials that hate each other, they can also be contradictive and thus lead to a conflictive perception of an object. So these two itineraries can conflict when being entangled within an object. And I aim to elucidate the conflict which happens due to the entanglement of conflicting itineraries within the same object due to different itineraries. To give you an example, this sounds overly complex, but in a case study which might help you to understand what I'm speaking about. Let's take something like my wedding ring made out of the substance gold. It's only one substance, it's gold. There's no doubt that the materiality of the wedding ring has the potential to evoke positive memories, especially in the moment of conscious feeling and observing the object, at least as long as one is happily married with his or her partner. I am still, so I mean, this is. The ring becomes a material manifestation of the partnership, which becomes materiality in the presence of the ring. However, what happens if one finds out that the gold of which the ring was made was deprived from the victims of the Second World War, whose dental gold was removed after their assassination and sold on the market? If the bearer of the ring hears about this horrible story of the substance, a negative itinerary of the substance gets into conflict with a positive itinerary of the materiality. Will the bearer of the ring be able to forget the itinerary of the substance and or to replace it with the positive associations of the itinerary of the materiality? Or will he remember the itinerary of the substance as a bad omen in the cases of divorce? I knew it had to happen because this is the bad gold. You know, it's not again the materiality, it's the substance which suddenly becomes relevant due to the shifting perception of the object, which I've called the first changeability. Both itineraries are inseparably entangled within the object. And depending on the particular situation, they unfold their effect due to raising memories while feeling and observing the object. They continuously generate the perception and meaning of the object as well as its value. During the itinerary of an object, its shape and substance can also change without any human interference. And Tim Ingold has manifold published on this issue. I will call this phenomenon the second changeability of the object. With time, the substance or substances and features of an object change, get lost, or are added. Food, my topic at the moment, deteriorates, changes its qualities, becomes inedible, sometimes even poisonous, or acquires a unique taste or alcoholic component. Ian Hodder pointed to the dependency between a mud brick wall and humans, who are continuously endangered by the permanent decay of the wall and the possible subsequent collapse of the building. A great amount of care, curation, as you would call it, is necessary to delay or stop the permanent change of the object. Functions and meanings of an object can change along with the object itself and its features. Some practices become impossible and others become possible just now. Meanings and memories which are bound to a specific feature of an object, for example, a specific substance, can get lost if, for example, a particular smell, color, a shape of an object is lost over time. And this memory was linked especially to this specific smell. So it's just a part of the object gets lost, but this was the part where the memory, which was relevant for the object, was associated to. The second changeability is no virtual changeability like the first one. The object changes in its materiality and or substance. It forces us to care for it. It has an effect and evokes practices and emotions. As all our worldviews are views on the world, the second changeability also has the potential to shape and transform our worldviews. One may think about deteriorating cities like Venice or Havana, or the efforts to preserve what we perceive as cultural heritage from decay. Already within the first and second changeability, the perception of an object and the practices with an object are closely interwoven. I define the third changeability as the transformation of objects in the course of human practices with the object. Objects are worn off, they bear traces of the use, sometimes only very fine scratches, sometimes very obvious cracks, spellings, holes, or other marks of their use. Just as the second changeability, the third one is not a perspective change of the object, but a real one. Whereas the transforming power of the second changeability is time, the relevant factor for the third is man, him, herself. These traces of use can become witnesses of past times and anchors of memory, which become the basis for the creation of meanings and histories. A spot of red wine on the bright carpet does not only have the potential to become a permanent nuisance, it can also remember us of glittering parties. Do you remember then when we were young, we made these parties? And, you know, it depends very much on the moment if I'm just annoyed by this spot, if I just think, yes, it was such a great party. So the hole in the jeans remembers us of past efforts and itineraries when feeling them while wearing the clothes, embodying basically these memories by feeling the holes in the clothes. At the same time, usewear also requests our care and also our reaction. We polish scratches, we mend holes or cracks and take care for objects. Again, objects have an effect on us. They possess an effectancy. I've just defined three different changeabilities of the objects, namely first, based on the continuously changing perception of the objects. Secondly, the change of objects through time without any human interference. And third, the transformation due to human practices with them. All three changeabilities are entangled with each other because the relevant factors for the transformation, perception, time, and practice, constitute each other. All three changeabilities can force humans to act. They constitute an object effectancy. Objects have an effect on us, and we do not have to associate their potential with any kind of intentionality, which again is so integral for agency. The notion of effectancy does far better justice to the specific character of things, their changeabilities, obstinacies, and dynamics. Things have an effect on us. They do not act in the sense. They enable and they hinder human action. They structure human action in a physical and psychical dimension due to their changeabilities, as acting with things also means perceiving things, and vice versa. In order to show the potential of my approach, I want to present a case study from the Eastern Mediterranean Late Bronze Age, which is the second half of the second millennium BCE. Starting in the 15th century BCE, a large number of Aegean pottery was transported from the Aegean to the southern Levant, and it started at the very beginning of the 15th century. And I want to start with one of the earliest imports that made their way, in this case from Crete, from the island of Crete to the southern Levant. These are two so-called conical cups found at the palace of Tel Betshemesh, excavated there in the early 14th century. And nice thing, it belonged, we can attribute it from literary sources. It was inhabited by Queen Belit Labiat, so it was basically the only palace that we've ever found in Levant where we can attribute it to ruler, and it's a female ruler. I just want to enforce that the normal thing is that we always think it's male ruler. Sorry, the only one where we know the name, it's a female ruler, but this is something different. So Belit Labiat was using these two cups. And it's very interesting because we have in the Aegean, you see them again now as we would show them in an archaeological publication. And in the Aegean, we have clear indications that drinkers that in pairs opposite each other, so these are frescoes from Aegean palaces, consuming beverages from pairs of nearly identical drinking vessels. Thus, for the Aegean gift giver, it was natural to send such a pair of vessels as a gift. Belit Labiat obviously kept the cups together as a pair as well. Drinking from cups, however, was not a common practice during feasting in the Levant. By examining the two cups closely, I was able to identify that on both cups the handles had been most probably chipped away. In other words, the users of the cups had transformed them into bowls. This fits very well to the common practice of drinking in the late Bronze Age southern Levant, where you don't have cups, you hold the drinking bowls in the palm of your hand, and it was much easier after removing the handle and transform the cups into bowls, and they manipulated them in order to fit better into what they perceived as the correct and embodied social act of drinking. The potential of these cups-bowls arose from their effectancy due to their changeabilities. During the process of appropriation, a human actor had the idea that only the handle distinguishes the cups from the much more useful shape of the bowl. It was the flexibility of the perception of the object, the first changeability, which was the prerequisite for its subsequent transformation. The removal of the handles also left clear traces of the former shape. And these traces, remember my third changeability, because it's traces of these practices with objects, could serve as a basis for narratives memorizing the origin and itinerary of the objects. After having presented my case study, I finally want to raise the question if I could not have reached my archaeological interpretation also without any concepts defined in the first part of my contribution. The value of every new concept or approach depends on its epistemological value, which means its range and importance of additional insights which became possible only after the conceptual and or methodological innovation. It is indeed possible to get very similar insights without applying any of my terms or related concepts and approaches by Tim Ingold, Hans-Peter Hahn, Bjørnar Olsen or Ian Hodder. It was my aim to create a vocabulary which enables us to differentiate and better describe the dynamics of things and interactions with humans by acknowledging their permanent transformation of their substance, what Tim has called materials, their being in and shaping our worlds, as Olsen emphasizes, their obstinacy and unnoticed existence, as Hans Hahn emphasizes, and the complex interrelation and dependency between them and humans, Hodder's entanglement. All these concepts are aware of the particular character of things, their substance and materialities, itineraries and dynamics. With the vocabulary presented here, the notion of the changeabilities of things due to perception, time, and practice, and a combination thereof. Yeah? And the differentiation of the itineraries of the materiality and the itinerary of the substance. I aim to supplement these existing approaches which enable us to refine our approaches and understanding. Moreover, effectancy as a novel term for the description of the overall potential of things and as an aim to replace agency helps us to avoid the anthropomorphization of things and apply a thing-specific vocabulary which does much better justice to them. Thank you very much for your attention.
May I now invite Tom